Hi there. I'm Marlon McGrath from the admissions office, and I want to add my voice of welcome to those of my colleagues, many of whom you've met by now. Today, I have the honor of being the ringleader, as it were, for a five ring circus. We have been able to persuade, in addition to persuading you all to join us, been able to persuade five members of our faculty to come and entertain us with a glimpse in each case of what kind of work, what sort of project, what sort of thing matters to him or her. And so they will come sequentially, and I will have the great pleasure now of introducing our first participant, our first actor, Ed Glaser, who is the Fred and Eleanor Glimp Professor of Economics, teaches microeconomic theory, and he's written dozens of books and articles. He now has a new book out. His particular focus, and part of the reason I thought it would be fun to ask Ed today, is that he works on the role of cities as centers of the transmission of ideas. Indeed, he's director of the Rappaport Center for Greater Boston. He has a joint appointment with the Kennedy School. He is a graduate of Princeton University, a very fine college in New Jersey. And before that, he went to the Collegiate School in New York City, and I'll bet there might be someone here today from that very fine place, too. Before I get off the stage and turn it over to Ed, I should acknowledge that he is a long-standing, very loyal, very valuable member of the Standing Committee on Admissions, so he will have read some folders from some people who end up at Harvard. Ed.
Thank you, Marlon, and I am so honored and so pleased to be able to talk to you in this temple of learning, this temple of truth. I want to start with a picture of America, and what I've done is I've taken the 3,000-odd counties in the United States, and I've ordered them on the basis of their density level, because at their hearts, cities are the absence of physical space between people. Cities are density, proximity, closeness. Now, what you can see in the bottom line, the blue line, is the relationship between density and earnings. The densest tenth of America's counties have earnings that are on average 50% higher than the least dense half of America's counties. This is something economists call agglomeration economies, the fact that we get more productive when surrounded by a maelstrom of economic activity. And it's not that we become more productive overnight. It's that people who come to cities see their wages increase year after year, month after month, because at their heart, cities are forges of human capital, places like Harvard, where we get smart by being around other smart people. Now, the top line shows the relationship between population growth and density. As you can see, it's an almost steady monotonic relationship. So whereas places at the start of the 19th century, whereas Americans were leaving their dense enclaves on the eastern seaboard to populate the empty spaces between the oceans, at the start of the 21st century, instead of spreading out, we are clustering in. We are going to the places that were already dense and just making them denser. Now, in some sense, this is a puzzle, because we live in an age in which we are told that distance is dead, in which we were told by the techno-prophets and the cyber-seers that we would all just go and disperse ourselves to electronic cottages and villages and just dial it in. And yet, we're not. Now, not so long ago, in the New York City of my youth, that would be in the 1970s, it really looked as if cities were headed for the trash heap of history, that not just President Ford, but history itself was telling New York to drop dead. And in those years, there wasn't much difference between Boston and Buffalo. Both looked like they were dying. There wasn't much difference between Detroit and Seattle, right? In 1971, two jokers put up a billboard on the highway leaving Seattle, asking the last person to leave the city to turn off the lights. Because just as no one could imagine a Detroit with a smaller General Motors, no one could imagine a Seattle with a smaller Boeing. This is before Amazon, before Microsoft, before Costco, and you know, Starbucks is just beginning to percolate some brew. But these cities did come back. Why did they come back? Why weren't the techno-prophets right? The reason is that what globalization and new technologies have done is they've radically increased the returns to human capital. They've increased the returns to skill. Because today, you can sell it on the other side of the planet, you can source it on the other side of the planet, and being an innovator, being on the cusp of new ideas, is an incredibly valuable thing. The great asset of cities at the start of the 21st century is their ability to make us smart, their ability to enable those collaborative chains of creativity that have powered humanity's greatest hits since Socrates and Plato bickered on an Athenian street corner right down to Facebook. And I'm not going to say any more about that for legal reasons. The role of cities as places of knowledge transfer explains why finance particularly loves cities, because there's no industry in which it is easier to become rich by knowing more than finance. It's an industry that has the highest returns to knowledge, and hence it loves cities. I've put up here a picture of the Wallace office at Bloomberg City Hall, which is modeled on the Wallace office at Bloomberg LLP, which is modeled on the Salomon Brothers trading floor, which Bloomberg ran in the 1970s. Now, there's something odd about trading floors, and I want you to just think about it for a second. Here we have some of the wealthiest people on the planet who, in a normal industry, would sit protected by giant oaken desks, would sit ensconced in large offices, would be protected by executive assistants. But they're on a trading floor. They're all on top of each other. They're all sweating on each other. They're all getting guacamole on each other, if Michael Lewis is to be believed. Right? Why are they there? Why are they putting up with that? Because knowledge is more important than space. Right? And that is why cities have come back. Because what globalization and new technology have done is they've made knowledge more important than space. There are a couple of other reasons why I like this picture. One of which is it reminds us of a chain of creativity in finance. And cities have always been about these chains of creativity. So think about Renaissance Florence in the 15th century. Brunelleschi figures out the basic mathematics of linear perspective, making two-dimensional spaces seem three-dimensional. He passes it along to Donatello. That would be the sculptor, not the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. Who puts it in low-relief sculpture on the wall of Orson Michele. Right? Passes it along to Masaccio, who puts it in painting in the marvelous Brancacci Chapel. St. Peter finding the silver coin in the belly of a fish. Passes it along to Fra Filippo Lippi, that less-than-saintly monk. Passes it along to Botticelli and so forth. A chain of genius, each person riffing on each other, each person doing something magical. And indeed, this is the same thing that happened in New York. Right? A basic understanding of how to trade off risk and return then got carried by people like the young Fisher Black to Wall Street. This then enabled people like the young Michael Milken to convince investors that his junk bonds carried enough rewards to offset the risk. These junk bonds then enabled the young Henry Kravis to engage in larger and larger leverage buyouts and so forth. Right? A chain of brilliance. And that's very much what we hope you will be part of here. This is very much part of what a learning environment where we all borrow ideas from each other all the time is all about. Now, I want to make one other point, though, about this face-to-face contact and why it's so valuable. The world has become more complicated. Ideas have become more complicated. And anyone who's ever taught knows the hard part about teaching is not knowing your subject material. It's knowing whether or not anything you're saying is getting through. Now, we have accumulated over millions of years these cues for communicating comprehension or confusion that are lost when we're not in the same room with one another. That's what face-to-face contact means. And when you come here, as I hope all of you do, parents as well as children, of course, right, you realize that it's not faculty that make the difference, it's each other. It's the fact that you're thrown into this maelstrom of what Harvard is. You're thrown into this atmosphere in which you'll breathe the air of ideas around you. And you'll teach yourselves, and at best faculty, when we work really hard at it, manage to direct the subject of conversation. Now, the role of ideas in fueling city growth explains why some cities have done better than others. Education is the best predictor which one of America's once declining cities have done better. So if you compare Seattle to Detroit, one half of Seattle's adults have college degrees, one in eight of Detroit's adults have college degrees. They're both doing exactly as well as that those skills should predict. This shows the relationship between population growth between 2000 and 2010. And initial share of the population with a college degree. Again, strong positive relationship. Skills really are destiny at the individual level, at the city level. And the city effects get magnified. This is something economists call human capital externalities. If the share of adults in your metropolitan area with a college degree goes up by 10%, your earnings go up by about 9%, holding your years of schooling constant. It really pays to have smart people around you. Now, many of the skills that matter in cities are not those that are taught at Harvard. Believe it or not, they're the skills that are learned on the streets. They are what Alfred Marshall, the great English economist, was talking about in the 19th century when he wrote that in dense clusters, the mysteries of the trade become no mystery, but are as it were in the air. There's nothing that is more important for the long-run vitality of a city than the talent and inclination to be an entrepreneur, to come up with new ideas, to seek new opportunities. If you want to, 50 years ago, the economist Ben Chinnitz was comparing New York and Pittsburgh and noting that New York seemed to be more resilient than Pittsburgh was even then. He argued that this was a reflection of New York's industrial history, its focus on the garment trade, an industry with very few barriers to entry in which anyone could get started, and many of these garment entrepreneurs did totally different things. They started movie studios, they built skyscrapers, And they went on and did, you know, amazing things. By contrast, Pittsburgh had U.S. Steel. U.S. Steel trained company men. Those company men were very productive in the short run, but very bad at looking for new opportunities. And when you think about your own career here, it has to be about both skills and entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship in every level. Entrepreneurship in your social relationships. Entrepreneurship in your intellectual relationships. You need to grab the opportunities that this amazing place will give you. Now, the most entrepreneurial place I've ever been is the Dharavi slum of Mumbai. Right? It is a place that is just crammed with human energy. You know, you walk down the street and there's some guys who are sewing brassieres, and you think you're in the Lower East Side of Manhattan in 1907. And then across the way, there are people who are recycling boxes by chopping them up and turning them inside out. Who knew there was a living in that? And yet the city told them that. And you feel so uplifted by the energy of India, and yet you walk out into the street, right, and you see a kid defecating in an unpaved road. And you know the water isn't fit to drink and the electricity is unreliable, right? And you just feel the enormous downsides of density. Because just as there is enormous promise in the fact that the poor world has become urban, right, that more than 50% of humanity now lives in cities, there are also enormous challenges. Now, there is no future in rural poverty, but the great challenge of the 21st century is making cities like Mumbai, places like Dharavi, livable and safe and places of opportunity for all. Now, one of the great challenges with doing research on the developing world is the availability of data. Often government data, particularly in poorer parts of the world, is really quite weak. And one of the things that's really neat is that we can increasingly use private data, in this case Google Street View, to tell us about income and poverty or the presence of things like open sewers. So what I've been doing with a computer scientist who'll be here for the next couple of years is we've been using Google Street View to measure wealth and poverty. And the way this works is you need to have some survey where you actually have wealth and poverty, and then you essentially use the pixels to predict wealth. If the prediction works well, you then have a measure of wealth based on the images on the pictures, and then you can use that to map wealth and poverty throughout the entire area. It turns out, I've done this for New York, it turns out this is how good the fit is. I can predict about 80% of the variation across New York City block groups just with the pixels. And we're still working on Indonesia, we're still working on Chile, we're still working on Pakistan. Now, the cities of the West have a long history in dealing with the demons that come with density, with contagious disease, with traffic congestion, with crime, with high housing costs, right? America's cities and towns once were places of death. A boy born in New York in 1900 could expect to live 7 years less than a rural American, right? This didn't change easily. America's cities and towns were spending as much on clean water at the start of the 20th century as the federal government was spending on everything except for the post office and the army, right? It took enormous investments in infrastructure to make this work, but infrastructure is not enough, right? The great piece of infrastructure investment in New York is the famous Croton Aqueduct. You will see it's built here. It was the story that I was told when I was a child was that, in fact, New York was unhealthy until the Croton Aqueduct brought in the clean waters of upstate, and then all of a sudden the city became healthy. Anyone see a great trend break here? Anyone see the death rates diminish immediately once those clean waters flew in? Of course not, right? 25 years later, New York is still having cholera epidemics. My five great-grandfather died in the 1849 cholera epidemic in New York City, right? It didn't start going down until after here, until we had rules to supplement the infrastructure. And the problem was that poor people weren't connecting. They weren't using the sewers. They weren't using the water. It was what we faced when my work that I do in Zambia today, but it's called the last mile problem of getting people to connect. And it wasn't until you imposed requirements on property owners to connect to the sewers, which reminds us that property is not just about empowering, it's also about creating obligations. We have the same behavioral issue in transportation. You can't just build your way out of traffic jams because something the economists Gilles Duranton and Matthew Turner have called the fundamental law of highway traffic. Vehicle miles traveled increase roughly one for one with highway miles built. If you build it, they will drive it, right? You cannot just keep on building highways and expect the problem to be solved because of the behavioral response. You need to charge people for the price of their roads. You need to have congestion pricing or some equivalent if you expect the roads to move quickly, as they do in Singapore, which is the second densest country on the world, and yet the streets move effortlessly because they charge people for the roads they use, because they charge people for the social costs of their actions. Now, cities have such promise for many reasons, but one of them is also environmental. And I want to illustrate this point with a story about a young Harvard College graduate, this could be you, right, in 1844, who went for a walk in the woods outside of Concord, Massachusetts, and he did a little fishing, and the fishing was good because there hadn't been much rain lately. And then he came to cook the fish into a chowder. That's what we do in New England, for those of you who are new here. We cook chowders all the time. And the wind flicked the flames to the nearby dry grass, and a fire started, and it spread, and it spread. And by the time it was done, it was a raging inferno that had burned up more than 300 acres of prime woodland, whole natural ecosystem destroyed by this young man. In his own day, he was castigated as an enemy of the environment. The Concord Freeman called him a flibberty gibbet, which I think was pretty bad for 1844. And indeed, it's hard to think of any young man at that time period who did as much damage to the environment as this character did, right? Oddly, of course, today he is revered as the secular saint of American environmentalism. His name is Henry David Thoreau, and his book Walden teaches the moral of what a wonderful thing it is to live surrounded by nature. And yet, living around nature doesn't seem to have been so wonderful for nature, does it? You know, indeed, I take away from Thoreau's life a different moral, which is that we are a destructive species, and if you love nature, you should stay away from it, as indeed Thoreau would have done much better for the plants if he had stayed at home. Now, I experienced this personally. This actually comes from statistical work with Matthew Kahn, where we estimate the carbon emissions associated with living in different parts of the country. And the places that look brown are green, and the places that look green are brown, precisely because of much smaller apartments, living in urban spaces, and even holding income family size constant and much longer drives. And I started to learn this personally when I began acquiring small children about 10 years ago. I moved from about here to about here, and what with the driving and the home heating, I started doing as much damage to the environment as Thoreau did. Another way of seeing this is that the great growing economies of India and China see their per capita carbon emissions rise to that seen in the sprawling United States. Global carbon emissions go up by about 130%. If they stop at the level seen at wealthy but hyperdense Hong Kong, global carbon emissions go up by less than 30%. Now, I don't want to end on a global warming point because it seems like a downer. The larger point, and it's true of Harvard and it's true of cities, is that for centuries, for millennia, the track record of our species, when we work together, when we learn from each other, when we collaborate in urban spaces, is just amazing. Humanity together has been doing miraculous things for millennia. And that, I think, is the real lesson of the city. And thank you for your time.
Jill Lepore, who will be our next speaker, is the David Woods Kemper Professor of American History. She teaches a huge variety of courses here, has a very active other life too, including, for example, writing books on her most recent book that I have loved the title of, is The Secret History of Wonder Woman, which is published in 2014. And she's about to release a new book this calendar year called Jo Gould's Teeth. She's from Massachusetts, from Wachusett Regional High School in Massachusetts before she went on to Tufts, and teaches a lot of our students, both undergraduates and graduate students. I am thrilled to introduce her. She may be familiar to some of you, as she was, in fact, to me before I met her in person, because she writes very often and quite compellingly in The New Yorker. So if the name rings a bell, here's the person. Jill, thank you.
Okay, hi, thanks so much. It's really nice to be here to meet all of you. Congratulations on getting into Harvard and coming to Cambridge. Give yourself a hand, yeah. Don't be so tentative. I want to talk this afternoon about how Wonder Woman got into Harvard. She had a much harder time than all of you, as difficult as those admissions and SAT applications and SATs were. Wonder Woman had to climb over the Harvard gates. Here you can see from a cartoon from 1944. So I want to talk about the importance of studying history and the humanities and why it is that a liberal arts education begins with a sense of the way in which we exist on a timeline, that all of the inquiry that we make into the world in which we live in some ways actually does begin with a question about the past. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the origins of Wonder Woman, which is an odd thing for me to talk about. I'm an American political historian. I'm not a comic books fan. I want to argue today that comic books, like everything else, has a history that can explain to us the world in which we live. This very building has a history that is incredibly illuminating, and not least the way in which it intersects with the history of Wonder Woman. So comic books started in the 1930s. The first superhero comic is Superman, which starts in 1938. Batman follows in 1939. And Wonder Woman debuts in 1941. Here she is in 1942. Wonder Woman was a publicity stunt by the company that became DC Comics. Because in the 1930s, Superman and Batman were subject to an enormous amount of criticism. Comic books were a new art form. Parents were really worried about their kids reading them. They seemed incredibly violent. In particular, their violence was very masculine. And also, Superman looked to a lot of Americans like a fascist. He comes from a master race. He's an Ubermensch. She's a Superman. So parents gathered in towns, in town commons, and burned comic books. Comic books were banned from schools. Batman carried a gun at a time when Americans were very upset about the private possession of firearms. So Wonder Woman was a publicity stunt by DC Comics aimed to quiet the critics of comic books, who said that comic books were too violent and too masculine in particular. She's the most iconic female superhero. Only Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman have been continuously in print since this era, which is known as the Golden Age of comics. Her creator was kept a secret. It was a trade secret who created Wonder Woman until she got her own comic book magazine, Wonder Woman Comics, in 1942, when what was released here was the name of the creator of Wonder Woman. He's this heavyset guy in the lower left with a jacket on in this page from Wonder Woman Comics from 1942 called The Men Behind Wonder Woman. And it was revealed that the creator of Wonder Woman was world-famous consulting psychologist William Moulton Marston. Marston had 3 degrees from Harvard. He had been an undergraduate here. He graduated in 1915. Then he went to Harvard Law School, graduated in 1918, served in the First World War briefly, and then finished a PhD in psychology here at Harvard in 1921. He was an extremely well-known psychologist. And it was Marston who said to DC Comics when he was hired as a consultant, you know what you need to do? If you want to have Americans stop burning comic books and libraries stop banning them, you need to have a female superhero. Because the future of the United States and of the world is the future of the empowerment of women. So in the press release, this huge press campaign that was launched to promote Wonder Woman in 1942, the claim that Wonder Woman was explicitly a feminist project was made again and again and again. So here, Wonder Woman was conceived by Dr. Marston to set up a standard among children and young people of strong, free, courageous womanhood, and to combat the idea that women are inferior to men, and to inspire girls to self-confidence and achievement in athletics, occupations, and professions monopolized by men, because the only hope for civilization is the greater freedom, development, and equality of women in all fields of human activity. This is where you applaud! Yay! As a historian, I came across this press release in DC Comics archives. It took me years to get into DC Comics archives. Let me tell you, it was worth the wait. This press release is incredible. In 1942, people who are publishing Wonder Woman it's a feminist manifesto, and it's so interesting. Why? Why would that happen? And you might think, you know, I ask my students this, and people say, well, it's trying to get women to work in the Second World War. It's the Rosie the Riveter era. Men are off fighting the Second World War. Women are supposed to go into the paid labor force and make munitions. That must be what this is all about. Well, in a way, that's true. That's a really good first thought. But the second thought is really where the true history lies. Wonder Woman, the comics themselves, are actually full of quite overt feminism. Wonder Woman comes to the United States from the land of the Amazons in order to fight for the equal rights of women. That is her whole mandate, her reason for being. She does things like run for president. Now, the careful viewer will note this is 1,000 years in the future. So I think, you know, supporters of Hillary Clinton should be proud that we didn't have to wait 1,000 years for at least the campaign stage to be erected. But there's something really interesting about the quite overt feminism of the character. And even privately, Marston, when he was asked, why did you create Wonder Woman, not just in a press release, but he would say things like this: Wonder Woman is psychological propaganda for the new type of woman who should, I believe, rule the world. So what's going on here in the 1940s? Well, there's something quite mysterious, in fact, about Wonder Woman. Superman and Batman, you kind of immediately know where they come from. Superman comes from science fiction, pulp science fiction, which was a huge popular literature beginning in the 1920s. Batman comes from detective fiction. Batman is basically just Dick Tracy in a ridiculous outfit. I mean, there's a huge reader interest in detective fiction in that era. But where does Wonder Woman come from? She seems to kind of come out of nowhere. And for a long time, for people who study comic books, she's been really quite mysterious. It's not just that she has a secret identity. She puts on glasses and pretends she's a secretary. But she actually really has quite a mysterious history. So I got to be really interested in Marston, the guy that created Wonder Woman. And this is for the parents in the room. This is Marston when he was a young, he's a 1-year-old. And here he is as a Harvard freshman. He became quite a handsome. But this is the journey that your children have traveled in the last 18 years. I love this photograph of him. This is his senior high school photograph, which is also his Harvard freshman photograph. So Marston gets to Harvard in 1911, and his world is upended by his time here, because Harvard at the time had only fairly recently been walled in and gated in. And one of the reasons for that, really frankly, was the establishment of Radcliffe College in the 1890s. Radcliffe was then the Women's College of Harvard, and women at Radcliffe took all their classes with Harvard faculty, but they were really not allowed in the yard. The yard was the bastion of men. Now, Marston, when he came, his faculty advisor, a philosopher named George Herbert Palmer, was married to the president of Wellesley College, a suffragist named Alice Freeman Palmer. And Marston's faculty advisor was the sponsor for the Harvard Men's League for Women's Suffrage, a pro-suffrage men's organization on campus. And the Harvard Men's League for Women's Suffrage, in the fall of Marston's freshman year, invited the British suffragist Emmeline Pankhurst to speak in Sanders Hall. And she agreed to come. She was doing a US tour. Now, Pankhurst was famous for bringing militancy. She's like the Martin Luther King of the suffrage movement. She famously did things like chain herself to the gates outside 10 Downing Street in order to protest women's lack of the right to vote. So she brought militant tactics to the suffrage movement, both in the United Kingdom and in the United States. At the time that the Harvard Men's League invited her to speak here in Saunders Hall, women were not allowed to speak at Harvard. And the Harvard Corporation held a special meeting to discuss whether or not to let Emmeline Pankhurst enter this room, and decided not. She was banned from speaking in any building owned by Harvard, which inspired a protest across the country. The Detroit Free Press famously had a headline of one of their stories called, "Is Harvard Afraid of Mrs. Pankhurst?" And the answer is, you bet. Harvard was terrified of Mrs. Pankhurst. So she spoke instead at a dance hall in Harvard Yard, in Harvard Square. And Marston went. So in other words, Marston, as a freshman here at Harvard, had a front row seat to the really important and very exciting militant suffragism that gained American women the right to vote by 1920. So when you look at his comics in Wonder Woman, the Wonder Woman comics from the 1940s, and Wonder Woman is always doing things like trying to leap over the walls to get into a campus, or disguising herself with a varsity sweater with an H on it to sneak into a lecture hall like this one, one of the things that really comes across when you think about Wonder Woman in relationship to Marston's own life is that the story of Wonder Woman is really Marston's witnessing of the early suffrage movement. He was also very much influenced by his wife here, Elizabeth Holloway, who went to Mount Holyoke College, where she played field hockey. Are there any field hockey players? No? I played field hockey, so I'm always looking for field. She played field hockey. She was on the staff of the Mount Holyoke magazine. But Mount Holyoke, which was a women's college, was a hotbed of suffragism. They had women's rights marches, they had suffrage parades, they had mock elections. The collegiate leader of the suffrage movement was Mount Holyoke, the place that Marston, when he would get on the train in Boston and go to visit his girlfriend at Mount Holyoke, spent most of his time when he wasn't in Cambridge. Marston is actually most famous not for creating Wonder Woman, but for his undergraduate thesis at Harvard, which he started in his junior year. Here he is with the glasses. William Moulton Marston invented the lie detector as a junior at Harvard when he was doing experiments in Harvard's psychological laboratory. Experimental psychology was new at the time. Harvard had the first experimental psychology laboratory. And Marston's advisor, Hugo Munsterberg, was a famous anti-suffragist. He did not believe women should have the right to vote. And he liked to do things like tie women up to machines in his laboratory in Emerson Hall. So Wonder Woman's arch nemesis, it turns out, is an evil psychologist named Dr. Psycho, who is always locking her up in the basement of his psychological laboratory. In other words, most of what happens in Wonder Woman happened here at Harvard first, and was Marston's observation of the way that men, in particular male scientists and social scientists, treated women students. Marston, interestingly enough, didn't have any money to go to Harvard. He paid his way himself through Harvard by writing screenplays for the silent movie industry. Here's one of his films about how it's autobiographical. It's about how he didn't make the football team his freshman year. This is a silent film that he wrote that was produced, directed by D.W. Griffith, the guy who made Birth of a Nation, about a young man whose fiancée discovers that he is keeping a maid in the closet, which also turns out to be autobiographical in Marston's case. We'll get to that in a minute. Marston married his college sweetheart, Elizabeth Holloway, the great suffragist from Mount Holyoke. She wanted to go to law school. Harvard didn't admit women to law school. She went to BU for law school. She wanted to get a PhD. Harvard did not admit women for a PhD. She went to Radcliffe and got a master's degree. And as the family tells it, she wrote her husband's PhD thesis. Marston went on to teach at Tufts, which is not too far from here, and is also my alma mater. And here he is 10 years later. Now he's 32, and here's his wife, EHM, Elizabeth Holloway Marston, at Tufts commencement in 1926, with a student who's graduating, Olive Byrne, who'd majored in psychology, and Olive Byrne's mother here. So this is the classic, you know, 4 years from now, you'll take this photograph, but please, dear God, don't let it be this photograph. Because the reason for this photograph is that Marston, among his many theories as a psychologist, he believed that men needed more than one sexual partner. And so he convinced his wife that they should bring young Olive Byrne, his undergraduate, into their house as their mistress, and that they would raise a family together. And they lived as a threesome for the rest of their lives. They raised four children together. This is important because this was a family secret. It was obviously an extremely scandalous family arrangement for someone who's known to give psychological advice. And it's also really important politically. It's the political history here that's of interest to me. Mother here, Olive Byrne's mother, Ethel Byrne, with her sister Margaret Sanger, founded the first feminist magazine in 1914 called The Woman Rebel, in which they coined the phrase birth control. You may have heard of Margaret Sanger, Olive Byrne's aunt, because she and Ethel Byrne founded Planned Parenthood in 1916 when they opened the first birth control clinic in the United States, for which they were both arrested within days and went to trial. They're here, this is Margaret Sanger on the left and Olive Byrne's mother, Ethel Byrne, on the right. Ethel Byrne was sent to prison for 30 days and went on a hunger strike in imitation of Emmeline Pankhurst. She nearly died, and she was pardoned because Margaret Sanger promised that she would never, her sister would never again be involved in the birth control movement. That's the only reason why Ethel Byrne is completely unknown and Margaret Sanger is one of the best known feminists of the 20th century. A deeply controversial person, but nevertheless important for me in trying to understand and research the history of this sort of poorly understood comic book character, because Margaret Sanger was a member of the family that created Wonder Woman. Sanger went on, after opening birth control clinics, to founding this magazine, The Birth Control Review, in 1923. And like suffrage cartoonists, feminist cartoonists and birth control activists used this conceit of women being chained and because the idea was that women were enslaved to men. So when Emmeline Pankhurst chained herself to the gates outside 10 Downing Street, it was a way to communicate that women were in chains because they didn't have the right to vote. Balls and chains make their appearance in Wonder Woman all over the place. They're very concerning and disturbing to look at iconographically, but they're an important part of the way in which the character is tied to the history of the suffrage movement. I just see if I can show you this. Maybe that's not going to work. There's a... I was going to show you a slide of Marston talking, but so anyway, Marston, after he created the lie detector, he taught at Tufts, established this unusual family arrangement, was teaching at Columbia for a while when it was discovered that he and his wife shared a mistress with whom they were raising their children. He was blacklisted from academic life, never again had another academic job, and so he went to Hollywood as an advisor to Universal and Paramount Studios. A lot of the films you've seen from the 1930s are films that Marston worked on. He was really interested in using his lie detector to determine what got audiences excited and what was too exciting for them to watch. So by 1940, when DC Comics is looking for someone to help them out with this new visual medium, the comic book, and a controversial audience reaction, the natural person for them to hire is William Moulton Marston, world-renowned consulting psychologist, whose family arrangements are completely hidden and secret, and his ties to Margaret Sanger, to the birth control movement, are entirely unknown, and remained unknown until just a couple of years ago when I wrote this book. So Marston says, oh, I have this great idea, it's all mine, it's my idea, we should create a female superhero. And then creates this superhero who is chained up like Emmeline Pankhurst, whose stories come from the suffrage movement, from the birth control movement, from the early feminist movement, and a lot from the efforts of women at Harvard to gain equality with men here. And the iconography of Wonder Woman draws quite explicitly from the suffrage cartoons of people like Lou Rogers, who, before she worked for Margaret Sanger's Birth Control Review, was a suffragist cartoon for a regular pro-suffrage page on a regular weekly magazine called Judge, where she did things like represent women in just the same fashion that Marston's artist Harry G. Peter did here, iconographically representing women breaking her chains, breaking the tyranny that men hold over her. Harry G. Peter, the guy that Marston hired to write to draw Wonder Woman, actually was a suffrage cartoonist with Lou Rogers. They were staff artists on the same magazine in the 19-teens. So Wonder Woman has this incredibly important history that had been utterly unknown, because by the 1940s, everybody forgot what suffrage cartoons looked like. And Wonder Woman looked like she was just engaged in some very sort of kinky bondage. But really, Wonder Woman's roots are in the suffrage iconography and the very particular political protests that suffragists and feminists and birth control activists waged in the 1910s. The real story, the secret of Wonder Woman isn't the men behind Wonder Woman, it's the many women behind Wonder Woman. This is really important in the world in which we live right now. In the movie theater near you, there's a Superman versus Batman movie showing that has this actress Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman represented in a very different way than the character is when she was represented as a suffragette. But I take a great deal of pleasure in a campaign run by a couple of undergraduate women a few years ago when they were running for the undergraduate council, that they ran as Wonder Woman trying to break into the gates of of Harvard Yard, dressed as Wonder Woman running to be representatives on the student body. So congratulations once again, and I hope that your entrance to Harvard is not so chaotic as this. Thanks.
Wow. Our next actor is known to a lot of people who know Harvard as the director of the Harvard Foundation, and that's almost nothing about why he's here today with us. Dr. Alan Counter is professor of, in his real other life, is professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. His work most of his life is focused on nerves and muscles and auditory hearing physiology, and at the moment he's investigating the neurobiological effects of lead and mercury exposure, a very important topic. He's done a lot of other things too. That's, I think, one of the themes of today. He's been for a number of years the Consul General of Sweden in Boston and in New England. He comes to us originally, in a way, from Roosevelt High School in West Palm Beach, Florida, via, for his medical training, Case Western Reserve. But we really think that he's a Harvard person, because this is where he did his real studies in neurobiology. So we've asked Dr. Alan Counter to come speak to us today about his scientific work. A lot of you will meet him in other roles later. Alan.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and I congratulate all of you on your acceptance to Harvard College. You've entered a great place. I've had the privilege of serving this institution for over 30 years, teaching the largest pre-med courses, some of the medical courses, and it's just been a great, great journey. I want to just quickly introduce you to someone who's very important to me. We have today, because we're going to have a week of activities centered around him, we have in our audience today the chairman of the Nobel Prize Committee on Literature, the person who gives the Nobel Prize in Literature in Stockholm, Sweden. He's Dr. Per Westerberg. Per, will you stand, please? He's a graduate of Harvard College, 1955, lived in Adams House. So you see, you can't go to Yale University and meet the head of the Nobel Prize Committee, so please know that. I'd like to share with you a story that's very dear to me, because I teach students here neuroscience and biophysics, as Dean Marlon Lewis said, and that's one thing we could talk about. But I want to talk to you today about something that's equally important to us at Harvard. We want to develop students who are not just automatons. We know you're all very bright. We want to develop people with compassion, people who have feelings for other people, for each other. We want to bring people together from diverse backgrounds who have an understanding of inclusion and equity and diversity. And so we really focus a lot on that here at Harvard, to create a sense of community, a sense of oneness. Because you're here for 3 years and 9 months, and after that you take off to the rest of the world. So I want to share with you a story about one of my experiences that involved the college. I involve students in everything. I'm a member of the Explorers Club of New York, so I climb mountains. I've lived in the Amazon. I've taken my students from Harvard College to the Amazon. I lived in the Andes Mountains with indigenous people. I take students there. I've even lived in Greenland, going toward the North Pole. I want to share a quick story with you. This is, I see you can begin this story, I think, by the first slide, and you can tell me when it's going to come on. So I think I've got it here, or you started here. I want to share very quickly with you a story of great importance to show you how we at Harvard have a very wide expanse here. And I think if it comes on, I'm still waiting. Normally that works. What about now? Any changes? Okay, good. And I think I can go back. I have great technical help here, as you can see, so you're going to make this work for me. Thank you. This is a PowerPoint thing. Go back to the first one, if you don't mind. Just go back one. And this is Veritas Thinks Big, so I'm going to talk about overcoming big obstacles to keep a promise. It's important to keep your word. Now, that's a part of compassion as well. Now, I'm going to move this forward, and I think it's with the arrow. Is that correct? Okay, very good. There. Now, imagine 1909, 1910. T.S. Eliot, whom Dr. Per Vesperi told me he heard read right in this very Sandoz Theater. T.S. Eliot was describing the era of exploration. We shall not cease from exploration. And the point of all of our exploring is to return to the place where we started and know that place for the first time. At that time, this entire country looked to the North Pole as being out in outer space. It was tantamount to reaching the moon in that time. Everybody here wanted to have somebody go to the top of Greenland to reach the North Pole. In Europe, throughout Europe, England, in Italy, the Duke de Abruzzi, in Denmark, in Sweden, in Norway, they were all trying to reach the North Pole. But one American was determined. In fact, he was obsessed with it. Now, who lives at the North Pole? People that we've traditionally called Eskimos. They were called at that time the Polar Eskimos. But we say today Inuit people. It comes from the word Inuish, which means the humans, because they thought they were the only humans on Earth. They live farther north than any other humans. And I know them as Uta, Oginwa, Okia, and Siglu. And they played an important part in American history, because whoever could reach the North Pole first could demand that it was America's military territory. And that's one of the reasons they were trying. Now, there was a man who was obsessed with this. He was from this area. He actually went to Bowdoin College. His name was Robert E. Peary, and he wanted to get to the top of the Earth to be the first human being to stand there. That meant so much. And again, it was like reaching the moon in our time. You could only get there by dog sled. It was some 400 or 500 miles north of the last spot of land, and that was the only way you could reach it. But nobody ever mentioned he had this man with him. He was an African-American from Washington, D.C. He was with Peary for all of the 18 years of exploration of trying to reach Greenland, but he was kept out of the history books. His name is Matthew Alexander Henson. The native people loved him because he spoke their language. He learned their culture. He taught Peary that he had to wear the indigenous people's garb in order to be successful. They call him Maripaluk, Matthew the Kind One. And he lived there in that area. Now, it was later admitted by Peary, because he had lost all the toes on his feet to frostbite, that it was Henson who took the American flag and planted it in the North Pole on April 6, 1909. That was so critical for America to maintain its status in the world. This man, Matthew Henson, with four Inuit, the one I've just named, they stood there at the North Pole. We can now prove that that happened. Well, I have an interest in that area. Many of the Inuit people are ill. They have trichinosis because they eat raw polar bear. They have other diseases that we wanted to study, and I was working with a Danish team. How do you get there? There's no American Airlines or Delta going to the top of the world. I had to fly military planes. You have to get clearance. So here I am on a C-141. Big military jet flying to the top of the Earth. That's the only way you get to Thule Air Base, which is the base where we watched the Soviet Union for 50 years with nuclear weapons stored right there. I'm going there to study. Among the things we study, most of the Inuit go deaf pretty early. The young boys start to lose their hearing at age 10 because they're hunting all the time. So I studied their hearing. You see, there's a rifle there. I went out with this woman. She'd go out to hunt as well. And we'd follow each other around on the teams, and I've been doing this for years to study all of their nerve impairment. And so I spent time doing that. That was part of my work. But let's get back to this man. Sometimes he would stay up there 4 years at a time. He was from a prominent American family. He was a commander in the Navy. He was married to a very lovely woman named Josephine. She was the daughter of a professor at Smithsonian Institution. And perhaps he got very lonely, because what people didn't know, and he kept a secret for so many years, was that he had an Inuit mistress, and there was this little white baby here that he had left behind and never told anyone. The things that men would do at that time. He just left him behind, and assuming that all would be forgotten and no one would ever know. And of course, he had his partner of 18 years working to reach the North Pole with him, struggling with this man that I described to you earlier, Matthew Hinson, and he too lived there for all that period of time. And of course, Hinson would never do anything like that, I thought. Let me see, I think they're out of line. Yes, he did. There's a little baby with an afro sitting right there. And he had a woman too, and her name was Akatingwa. The first woman was Alakasina. And they were born days apart on Peary's ship. One little part African-American Inuit kid, and one little part European-American kid. And they left them there, and no one ever heard about them. And then comes this silly little Harvard professor who teaches neuroscience at Harvard and biophysics, and he's just up there looking around. And what did he find? He found both of them. At age 80, and there they were, Anauka on the left side here, Anauka Hinson, and on the other side is Carly Peary, Admiral Peary's son and Hinson's son. They didn't want you to know about them, and sure enough, I found them. Now, it's one thing to find people. I spent time with them. I travel out, and I rush through these. I would go out. They were still hunting. We're on our dog sled. They would go out to hunt their seal traps. I love this. I took students with me, and we'd go out, and then you see, I got to know them, and I came to know them very well. I would eat their food. We had some nice walrus head. That's delicious. Everything is eaten raw. If you've never eaten walrus head, you don't know what you're missing. It's very delicious, and that's the grandson of Hinson. He's a full-time hunter, and then when we have delicacies in the house, we have a giant walrus heart. Like you have potato chips and dips, we eat walrus heart. It is so good. It tastes like cardiac muscle. I mean, it's really great. That's what we do at Harvard, these exciting things, you see. And so that's Peary's grandson, or his great-grandson. He's a hunter still today. I brought him down here to Harvard. He's an amazing young man, but he goes out hunting with his screen and his rifle to shoot seals and walruses so they can stay alive, just like we eat cows and pork or whatever. That's what they eat. And there's the youngest one. We built an igloo together. There he is in his igloo. That's Matthew Hinson's great-grandson, Mashingwak, who became a dear friend of mine. And so you see, these are quite interesting people. And just before I left, the two of them came to me and said, you know, we're going to die soon. Most of our people here as Eskimos don't live beyond about 65. We're 80, we're going to die. And we have one dream we've had since we were children. Our fathers abandoned us. Can you help us, Alan Paluk, they called me. Can you help us just to go to the land of our fathers before we die and touch the skin of a relative? I never had anybody ask me about anything like that. Can you help us go and just touch the skin of a relative before we die? We've never seen any of our relatives anywhere, and we must have some. I gave them my word, and that's the whole point of this. You have to try. I said to them, I don't know I can do it. It's a huge obstacle. I mean, there's no airline flying here. I have to get permission from the U.S. Air Force, from the Defense Department. I said, but I will try, I promise you. Sure enough, I wrote the President of the United States. We think big at Harvard. And I said, would you please help me? I shared the story with him. And before I knew it, I had a letter from Ronald Reagan saying, I'm so moved, I'll be happy to help you. So I was so pleased, I told them, I went back up to see them. I flew them out of their villages by helicopter. And I said to them, you're going to see your relatives. They were so happy, they were in tears. I put them on a big C-141. We call it the green, jolly green giant. It's huge, it's so magnificent a plane. And I had my students on there too. And I had student hosts for each of them because they brought 12 of their respective children right here to Harvard. We flew them in and there's the president of Harvard in this very building. President Derek Bok gave them a banquet. They had never been any place before out of their village. This was just overwhelming to them. These two little Inuit men who had dreamed of coming to the land of their fathers. They got here to Harvard and they were treated very beautifully. And the man to the right of the president is John H. Johnson, who is the founder of Ebony magazine. He actually sponsored most of this because Henson had helped him to get his magazine started. Here he met his relatives for the first time. He said, I knew I must have relatives. So he brought gifts from Greenland. He's meeting his American relatives. This is Matthew Henson's son, Anauka, for the first time. Now, sadly, and it's in the book if you want to read it, it's called North Pole Legacy. Sadly, the white families did not want to meet Kali. They felt that it would embarrass their family name. They felt that the revelation of having a, quote, they call it, illegitimate child by their grandfather would embarrass the family name. I argue that there is no illegitimate child. They're only illegitimate parents. And so I said to them, I'm going to find a way. And my students here at Harvard were really upset. They wanted him, Kali, to see his family. We went to New York, and all of the black churches, they welcomed Kali like he was a family member. They would ask him to stand and applaud him. And he would say to me, the Kalnaktuko people are fine. Kalnaktuko means dark. Kaduna means light. He said, they are so fine to me. But finally, I kept calling the Perry family, saying, please let him meet his family. I learned he had an 83-year-old brother alive not far from here. Finally, my grandmother said, have you talked to any of the women in the family? I said, no. She said, that's your problem. Call the women in the family. I called the wife of the son of Perry. He had an 83-year-old son. She said, bring him on up. So for the first time in his life, Kali Perry, I drove him with 12 students all the way to Augusta, Maine, 12 Harvard students. He met his brother for the first time. That's all he ever wanted to do, to touch the skin of a relative. Well, he wanted to lay a wreath at his father's grave, so I got him to do that in Arlington National Cemetery. There he is, laying a wreath at his father's grave. Perry was put in this giant, beautiful tomb by National Geographic, but National Geographic did not want to take part in the burial of a colored person at that time. So what they did was Henson was buried in this common grave. And the Eskimos asked me, why is Henson, who was so close to Perry, buried in this common little grave, and Mr. Perry's in the giant tomb? How do you explain that? They were such good friends. I couldn't explain to them the nature of racial differences in our society at that time. But I promised them I would do something to change this. So what did I do? I wrote the President of the United States. So the President of the United States said, yes, I could disinter Henson's remains from this common grave and reinter them among other American heroes in Arlington National Cemetery. The man you see to the right there in the white garb is the Reverend Professor Peter J. Gomes, who until recently, after 40 years, was our minister here, the chaplain of the Navy, the first black astronaut in space, Jan Bluford, is there in the blue suit. And look at the pallbearers. That's Henson's grave, Henson's casket. We were able to get new caskets for them and bury him and his wife in Arlington National Cemetery. So right beside Perry's beautiful, large, white granite monument that National Geographic built for Perry, I was able to put a large black granite monument right there. And you see with Henson's face in bas relief, and I included the name of all of the Inuits, all of the Eskimos, on the gravesite. And we unveiled that in Arlington National Cemetery. It was quite an achievement. And the last part of this, we got a stamp name for him with Perry and Henson both on it. We even got a ship name for him, the USNS Henson. It's an explorer ship. And there it is. Really a spy ship, I think, but it's an explorer ship. And there it is. And I went on the maiden voyage with my daughter, Philippa. You see her saluting. She's here today. She was 10 years old. And we went out on this big, beautiful ship on the maiden voyage. And then we got Henson a title. He never had a title. the Navy finally named him Command Master Chief after about 20 letters from me to every admiral in the Navy begging them to please give him a title, and they did. But here's the end of this very quickly. They said to me, when the anniversary of the discovery of the North Pole comes around in 2009, we want you to go to the North Pole and call our fathers' names out. How do you do that? I said, well, I give you my word again, I will try. You have to overcome big obstacles. So I tried to head out there. So I built this as a capsule case, the American flag, the Holy Bible that Henson carried with him, or one like the one he carried with him, to the North Pole, books by Perry and Henson, polar bear claws and sealskin gloves that are sacred to the Inuit Eskimo people. And I put this case together, and I had to get this, I had a backup one, by the way, I had to get this to the North Pole by April 6, 2009, and that's the end of this. I started off trying to get there. I got a letter from our new president, who was so nice to take all the way there with him, President Obama, who liked this idea. And there I have the letter, and I was going to deliver it to the families. And there, the Air Force came to visit me at Harvard, said, we like this idea, we're going to fly you there on a C-130. I said, great, I can take the Henson family and the Perry family from Greenland. We land at the North Pole, we get out, we call their father's names, we read a paper or whatever, and they said, great. About 4 weeks later, they called me back and said, we're sorry, we can't do it. Because of global warming, you need 3 meters of ice to land that big C-130 at the North Pole. And it turns out, I'd heard from a Swedish Navy person that the Russians had lost a plane there because it was only 1 meter of ice there at the North Pole, so they couldn't land. We had to overcome another big obstacle. I was going to keep my word to these old men. So in short, I chartered another plane, a smaller one. And I needed some courage. I needed somebody to be with me because this was just getting to be too much. So I asked my 16-year-old daughter, Olivia, to join me. And she had the courage to join her father to go there. And there we are. We flew by jumping across Canada all the way to the top of the earth. That's the last village on the earth, by the way, people. The last settlement called Karnak, north of our military base, Thule. So we were able to land the plane there and go in. I was going to take the seats out, put in barrels so we could take off, use the fuel in the barrels to get to the North Pole. I was still prepared to go to keep my word. It turns out that we tried that. We landed. We got with the Eskimo people. That's my daughter, Olivia, some of the Inuit families who were part of the Perry Henson family. We stayed there. There's Olivia with Aviat, Henson's great-granddaughter, who's a teacher in Greenland now. And we were talking about how we're going to get to the North Pole. We decided to celebrate. We brought all the Hensons and all the Perrys together. These are the children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren of those two explorers. And I leave you with this. I also gave President Obama's letter to the Inuit people. You can see the Greenland flag, the American flag. And they wanted a picture of the first family. They said, all the Eskimos up here, we voted for President Obama. I say, how could you vote? But they loved him. And so we had a cake. It says 100 Or, which is Danish for years. Perry and Henson, that's the grandson of Robert Perry on the left. And over to the right there is the grandson of Henson. We celebrated with a cake. And we were all set to go to the North Pole. But the pilot said, no, we can't do it. We'd die. We could make it there, but we might not be able to make it back. Now, I've been around a long time, and I'm not afraid of falling out of whatever. But I had my daughter with me, and I was not going to take a chance with her life. So I told him, well, how do we do it? He said, well, the only way you can do it is by dog sled. And I said, well, we'll try. So I trained my daughter Olivia to use the dog whip. And we're going to go to the North Pole. And there we are, we're headed. But we realized we couldn't go the 400 miles. And so I said, I have to give up. And Olivia said, Dad, you never give up. And that was encouraging to me. You know, is the Latin invenium aut fossium, means I'll find a way or I'll make one. And it turns out we decided I should call Admiral Melvin G. Williams, Jr., the commander of the Second Fleet. If we can't get there by air, if we can't get there by dog sled, if we can't get there with an icebreaker, maybe I can get there under the sea. So I contacted Admiral Melvin G. Williams, Jr. and said, could you give me a submarine? He said, he couldn't say yes or no. You don't say that in the military. He said these words. I think we can find a way to support this patriotic and historic endeavor. That's what you say, you know. And so sure enough, He said, can you rendezvous with the USS Annapolis? I've got a nuclear submarine up there, a hunter-killer submarine. I said, what you're supposed to? Yes, we can. So sure enough, you think big at Harvard, don't we? This is the USS Annapolis breaking through the ice. The commemorative case was delivered, and sure enough, there it is in the ice. You see the case there, the crew got out, and there they are with the case you just saw. That's Commander Michael Bruner, who commands the USS Annapolis, a nuclear submarine with 12 vertical tubes for nuclear-tipped Tomahawk missiles, and they take my little case out. Here's at the North Pole, commanding officers, and Perry's and Hinson's names were read. We achieved our goal, and we returned the ship. The ship came back to New Groton, Connecticut, and I took a group of Harvard students down. Here's the case being returned by Admiral Melvin G. Williams, Jr., the man to the right, who was in charge of the submarine fleet, who gave me that nuclear submarine, and the Commander Bruner, and then my Harvard students, and I'll end it there. So when you come to Harvard, students, you get great opportunities. You even get a chance to go to this.
So now I do have the pleasure of introducing Maya Jasanoff, as I said earlier, graduate of Harvard College, who is now the Coolidge Professor of History, who is one of our most beloved and admired teachers. It's always hard for me to imagine how people turn themselves into beloved teachers when they do as much other stuff as she does. But in any case, she's written a book called Liberty's Exiles, which is wonderful. I'm only saying this because I've been reading it, and it's really quite wonderful. She's now working on a book about Joseph Conrad. But she will speak to us as a graduate of Harvard College, as a great historian and writer who writes things that we actually like to read, and as a graduate of Ithaca High School in New York. Maya.
So I've been told that we're running really short on time, and so I'm just going to cut to the chase. I mean, congratulations, you got in. So come. All right. I want us to start today with an act of imagination. Oops. I want you to imagine an interconnected world. This is a world in which you can travel across countries fairly easily. In fact, you can travel across most of Europe without even having a passport. This is a world in which new technologies are making it possible for information to travel across the world as never before. Tokyo, Paris, New York, Buenos Aires, connected like that. This is a world in which there's great kinds of opportunities coming up in areas of, again, technology and information exchange, enormous amounts of migration around the world. It's also a time, though, in which the leading power of the world is starting to feel itself teetering a little bit. It's starting to feel that other kinds of powers are coming up, and it's worried that it might be losing its place. And this is a world, too, in which globalization losers are feeling like their jobs are getting squeezed in an era of enormous free trade, for example. They're feeling like inequality is rising. They're feeling like political systems are really unresponsive, and the conditions are totally ripe for the rise of populists and demagogues. If this world sounds to you a lot like the world today, you're wrong. Well, you're right, but it also sounds like the world of another time, and that is the world around 1900, about 100 years ago, when all of the things that I just described were already in evidence. Now, the process of what we call globalization, the interconnection of markets, of peoples, of ideas, this is a process that is as old as human history itself. And for me, as a historian, this is the thing that I really think is the central story of history. The central story for me is, how do people and ideas, goods, how do all these things move across borders? It's a story that we can trace back 250,000 years ago. We can trace it actually using sources that are written in our own bodies, in our DNA. And we can trace the movement of humanity from continent to continent from 250,000 years ago. And now and then in history, there are sort of step changes in the scale and the range of this kind of intercontinental connection. 4,000 years ago, ancient trade networks. 600 years ago, 500 years ago, the Columbian Exchange, transatlantic. Until we get to this world around 1900, a world in which we can see a sort of boom going up in the level, the range, the scale of interconnection, a boom that peaks around 1913, right at the eve of World War I, and that will not be matched again until the latest version picking up in the 1980s, when all of these kinds of processes of interconnection begin to take off again. Now, social scientists tend to study globalization with devices like this, something that you can chart and something that you can graph, looking at economics, for example, among other things. As a historian, what I am really interested in, though, is what all of this means for you and for me. What does this mean for ordinary people's lives? What does this mean for the people who are caught up in it? To get a sense of that, let me introduce you to a 17-year-old young man. His name is Józef Teodor Konrad Korzeniowski. He was 17 in the early 1870s. He had been born in 1857 in an area of present-day Ukraine, which at the time was part of the Russian Empire. Konrad Korzeniowski was raised to parents who were really avid Polish nationalists. This was a time at which there was no state of Poland, and as an ethnic Pole raised in this area of the Russian Empire, he was an ethnic minority. His parents fought to try to get a Polish state established in Eastern Europe, and for their pains, for their effort, for their struggle, they were persecuted and indeed prosecuted by the Russian authorities. His father was imprisoned, and both of his parents, along with him, were sent into exile in different, rather inhospitable parts of the Russian Empire. They did not have Dr. Counter's technology, nor did they have his appetite for raw polar bear and the other kinds of things that you find in inhospitable parts of the North. But instead they moved from place to place to place, and this young man, Korzeniowski, was raised against the backdrop of sort of real political tribulations, and also watched his parents really suffer from the kind of experience they had. They both contracted tuberculosis. At first, his mother died when he was 8 years old, and by the time he was 11, he was an orphan. And I think it may have been because of this childhood on the move from place to place, a childhood as really a displaced person, a stateless person, and a migrant, that by the time he was 17, Józef Korzeniowski had developed a fantasy about what he wanted to do with himself, and it wasn't a fantasy that involved going to Harvard. It was a fantasy that instead involved becoming a sailor and going to sea. After all, he had been adrift his entire life. And this picture is taken of him right at the time that he's about to set off on his great journey to go to Marseille in France, where he is going to start to learn to be a sailor. He's been raised speaking French. He goes off to Marseille, starts to be a sailor. And for the next 20 years, Korzeniowski will pursue a career as a sailor, mostly on British ships, as it happens. You see him here having grown a beard, a hipster avant la lettre. He will travel around the world, mostly on British ships, going to Asia, going to Australia, even going to Africa. Now, why is this story of Korzeniowski interesting from the point of view of getting a sense of globalization from within? Well, there are a number of things about his life that I think can tell us something about conditions that we live in now. One is he is stateless and he is an immigrant. And he's eventually going to find a home for himself in one of the great capitals of cosmopolitan Europe and indeed the cosmopolitan world, and that is the city of London, which to this day is one of the most international places in the world. He's also a guy who is working in one of the industries as a sailor that is most responsible for knitting together the world with all of those lines and connections and transporting bigger numbers of migrants around the world than has ever before been the case. And as a sailor, He's seeing these parts of the world, and he's also engaged in an industry which is in this period undergoing an enormous amount of technological change. Something else very significant from this world of about 100 years ago is that the world of sort of wind power and so on, sailing ships, is giving way to the diesel-powered, fossil fuel-powered era that we still live with. Now, sailing ships are being displaced by steamships, and the world of work that he's in is really changing. Finally, he does see the world, right? He goes out to Asia, Africa, etc. He sees the places that are being knitted together through these networks of shipping and communications and capitalism, among other things. And he also sees, and this is important, he also sees the places and the people that in some ways are left out by these systems, by traveling out beyond the range, as he will put it, beyond the range of the telegraph wires, beyond the range of some of the steamship lines. So there are a lot of reasons this fellow, Korzeniowski, is of interest to me as an illustration of globalization. But it's what he does next when he leaves the sea that makes me most intrigued by his story. Because Józef Teodor Konrad Korzeniowski, born in Ukraine, speaking Polish, moving to France to become a sailor, finds a home in London. And when he retires from the sea in his 30s, he takes up a new career. And that career is to be a novelist, a full-time writer in English, his third language, a language that he learned only in his early 20s. And he ends up taking on an English name, Joseph Conrad. And under that name, Joseph Conrad, he becomes responsible for producing one of the most influential bodies of literature for his era. Now, put your hand up if you have read a work by Joseph Conrad. I am very heartened to see this. And let me make a proposal for your next kind of 24 hours of visitas. Instead of asking people, where are you from? Where'd you go to high school? Where else are you considering? What's your favorite Conrad novel? It's a great conversation starter, I have to tell you. So in these works that Conrad wrote, it's really an over of extraordinary geographical and topical range. He writes novels that are set in Europe. He writes novels set in Asia, set in South America, and set most famously for most of you today in Africa, when he fictionalizes that journey that he took in Africa as a sailor to create his enduring novella, Heart of Darkness. And in these books of Conrad's, he's really focused on characters who are navigating the realm of globalization, who are navigating the forces of multinational capitalism and nationalism and imperialism and migration and technological change. And in his fiction, these are forces that are both opening up possibilities for people in the way they had opened up possibilities for him, but they also come with risks, and they come with costs, and they come with constraints. And he's interested in his fiction also in writing about the people who don't have a state, the sailors who can't find work in steam when technology changes their industry. He's interested in the backwaters, quite literally, where progress has not entirely made it. And he's also interested in the places where progress is actually a cover for imperialism and expropriation, as it is in Heart of Darkness. Conrad places special attention, I think, on these moments when ordinary people are making critical choices about how to act and also how to react to forces that are bigger than themselves. So what's the moral of Conrad's story as a lesson in globalization? Well, I could tell you that life is a process of discovery and self-invention. I could urge you to see the world. I could urge you to be creative in your pursuits. I could urge you to find and follow your passion. And I could urge you, of course, not to screw up the choice that you have in front of you right now, which is, of course, the choice that you need to come to Harvard. But I want to leave you instead with another thought. And this other thought is about imagination. You know, you don't even have to imagine an interconnected world. In this room right now, there is gathered an incredible cross-section of the ethnicities, the socioeconomic backgrounds, the nationalities, and of course the talents of this world, in this room right now. And if you come to Harvard, you will be encouraged to leverage those connections in order to make your own experience of the world that much richer, that much deeper, and that much more wide-ranging. So you don't have to imagine the interconnected world. You are in it, and you are of it, and you are making it right now. I want to encourage you instead, and in addition, to imagine your way out of that world. Don't forget the other things that are out there. I want you to imagine what else and what if. I want you to imagine who else and what then. I want you to imagine that the choices that you are making now are choices that are going to shape those futures. And I want you to remember that the difference between what you know and what you imagine, the space between what you know and what you imagine, is the space where the really good stuff is going to happen, and also the really important things, too. Thanks very much.
Last but not least, I get to introduce one of our own, graduate of Harvard College. I remember when you were an undergraduate. David Malin is now the Gordon MacKay Professor of the Practice of Computer Science in the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, and is a member of the faculty of the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He teaches Computer Science 50, which is the largest course in Harvard College, and which also is the largest course at Yale, where they have franchised us. That wonderful course provides an introduction to computer scientists for concentrators and non-concentrators alike, including people who've never done any programming. He also teaches in the Extension School and a number of other venues, and all of his courses are available on OpenCourseWare. He's done other things, too. As a graduate student, he worked part-time at the Middlesex District Attorney's Office, get this, as a forensic investigator, and he founded his own startup, The Modern World Upon Us. He's a graduate. He came to Harvard College as a graduate of the Brunswick School in Greenwich, Connecticut. We have a heavy concentration of New Englanders today. And I will now yield the stage to David. Thank you.
My name is David Malin, and I teach a course called CS50, which is our introductory course in computer science for concentrators and non-concentrators alike. And it's a course I myself took, albeit not initially, some time ago. Indeed, when I arrived on campus here, I wasn't sure what I wanted to study. In fact, the course catalog itself was completely daunting in so many new fields. And so I, frankly, rather gravitated naturally toward what I already knew. I thought back on high school, and I liked history a bit, and I really liked this constitutional law class. And so when I was flipping through the catalog, I realized, well, maybe government is what I should concentrate in. And I still had this curiosity about computer science, but then and now, to some extent, it was very much this course and more generally this field to beware. I just kind of figured that everyone who's taking the introductory course, CS50, must surely have been programming or taking computer science since they were 12 years old. I remember looking through the glass of window of the computer science classroom in my high school and not really knowing or really caring what like my own friends were doing in there. It just seemed so foreign and so unfamiliar to me. And it wasn't until sophomore year that I finally got up the nerve to put my toe in the water. And even then, it was only by enrolling in the class pass-fail, lest I fail the class or get a B in the class. It was my way of getting up the nerve to try what was a very unfamiliar field. And what I realized immediately is that even though I had this perception from high school especially that computer science is programming and writing code and sort of heads down, typing away on a keyboard, it's actually much more than that. It really is about ideas, and it's about problem solving, and in fact, it's about using techniques and using ideas that were actually pretty familiar to me already. In fact, the idea, one such idea that I'd like to propose is just this today, just one of several ideas, that of abstraction. And abstraction is a fancy way of saying taking something that's really complex and sort of taking a step back and packaging it up in a way that's simpler and that from the top down you can just understand. For instance, I to this day have absolutely no idea how a car works or underneath the hood, what's inside the engine, if something broke, would have no idea how to fix it. But I've gotten pretty good at using that machine and interfacing with this API or application programming interface whereby I get in the chair, and I turn the wheel, and the thing turns, and I push the pedal down, and I understand that. And that's what's key. I've abstracted away, as have all of us, we've abstracted away what a car actually is to only needing to understand and care about and master its interface. And in fact, underneath the hood, all of those details can change. It can go from gas to electric. But at the end of the day, other than filling it up, it doesn't really matter to me when operating that device what's going on underneath the hood. And consider some other examples. For instance, what is a country when we talk about a country? Well, in this country, a country is a collection of states. Well, what's a state? Well, a state is a whole bunch of towns. Well, what's a town? A town is a whole bunch of houses. Well, what's a house? Well, it's like four walls and a roof. But what's a wall and a roof? Well, it's, you know, previously wood and from a forest or trees that have been turned into 2x4s or the like. So if you get down to the nitty gritty, you could actually build the thing from the ground up. But we humans generally don't have to care about reconstructing things from those basics. We have the luxury of talking about fairly complex ideas from the top down in a way that just makes them so much more manageable and so much more understandable. Now let's consider things that are a little more technological, like in a computer. At the end of the day, a computer's only input source is like a power cable or maybe a battery. And even if you don't understand how the computer works, you probably know that there's electricity coming out of that cable or battery, so there's like electrons flowing in and out. But at the end of the day, that's the only input to this device. And yet, how can it do so much? How can I write my essays on it and send emails and browse the web and watch videos and listen to music? How did we get to such complexity when the only input at the end of the day is power or electricity? And in fact, what's going on underneath the hood in this case, if we glance there just quickly, is you have all these little switches inside of a computer, transistors, as they might be called, millions these days. And they're just little switches that, given some electricity, allow you to turn something on or off. On or off. And a computer scientist would typically call on 1 and would call off 0. And it would seem then that our only vocabulary is zeros and ones. But how do we get from zeros and ones to our emails and to images and to videos and music? Well, let's consider just what we humans know more familiarly is like the number 123. This is just a pattern of symbols, 1, 2, 3. But why is it 123? Think back just a few years to grade school, and you might recall that this is the ones column, the tens column, and the hundreds column. And now, how do we get from these columns to an actual value we understand? Well, this is what? 100 times 1 plus 2 times 10 plus 1 times 3, which of course is 100 plus 20 plus 3. Ah, there's my 123. Well, it turns out that computers aren't as fancy as we humans. We have 0 and 9 at our disposal, typically, so-called decimal system. Computers just have the binary system, bi meaning 2, because they just have zeros and ones, off and on. So in the world of computers underneath the hood, the best we can do is not having powers of 10 up there up top, 1, 10, 100, 1,000, but rather the ones column, the twos column, the fours column, on up. In other words, we can only use powers of 2 in this case. So how in this world might I represent the number we humans know as 0? A computer underneath the hood just turns off 3 switches, so it's off, 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 0, 0, 0. This then is 0. How do we represent using a pattern of switches or lights the number we humans would know as 1? Again, even if you're unfamiliar with computing and binary, at the end of the day, you just need those columns. So what's the pattern? Something, something, something will give me the number we humans know as 1. What's that pattern? 001. It's really as simple as that. Well, how about the number we humans know as 2? How instead would we write this? Not just 001, but rather 010. And if I want to count up further, I can do 011, which now gives me 3. So that's it. That's binary. Now we've gone from this low-level input, just electricity flowing in and out of the device, to being able to represent numbers. And in fact, if I just keep adding more zeros and ones to the left, just like you can make decimal numbers bigger, I can represent any number I might want. But how do you represent an email then? How do you send, for instance, the message hi, exclamation point, or draw something like a flower on the screen as an image that you might see on Facebook or the like? Well, how can we decompose this? Well, you know what? Why don't we just decide as society that this pattern of zeros and ones is just going to represent 3 numbers. In fact, I could do up the math, the ones place, twos place, fours place, 8, 16, 32, and so forth. I can convert those, if I did a little quick math, into these decimal values, which is a little more manageable in my mind, 72, 73, 33. Well, it turns out that humanity just decided some time ago that this number 72, in the context of an email or Microsoft Word or the like, is just going to be known as representing the letter H, followed by I, followed by exclamation point. An arbitrary mapping, but one we humans all agreed upon some time ago. Meanwhile, if I take this same pattern of bits and think of it in the context of like a web browser or Adobe Photoshop or something like that, now these patterns of bits, just by nature of the software I'm using, can be considered in a different context. So yes, it's still the numbers 72, 73, and 33. But what this really means in the context of graphics software is give me a little bit of red, a little bit of green, and a little less blue. Again, 72, 73, and then 33. And this is an RGB triple, red, green, blue. If you've ever heard the expression RGB, combine those three colors together, and you get this sort of very, very murky yellow brown that just barely shows up on the screen here. But now, henceforth, I do not care how murky yellow is implemented. You really can't see it. I do not care how the word hi is represented. I just want to get real work done and send an email. And I've abstracted away those low-level implementation details, so to speak, such that I know the computer can do it, but I just don't need to care. Now I can function at a higher level, so to speak. So from there, we have, unfortunately, a realization that abstraction is really, really useful. And it's kind of hard to operate without it. And in fact, if you can't take for granted what something is, but instead have to consider lower level how to make it, you realize a challenge. In fact, could I invite one brave pre-frosh to come on up on stage and appear before all of his or her potential classmates? You have to be comfortable appearing on cameras and therefore the internet. But if that hasn't set too high of a bar, anyone? There's like three hands in this audience, total 4, 5, 6. Now this is a little litmus test. OK, I see bouncing in one seat. So all right, that works. Come on down. And meanwhile, if those of you still seated can pick up that white sheet of paper that has been sitting near you, and if you have not received one, tear someone's in half next to you and grab the pencil we gave you or something else. And what is your name?
Catherine.
This is Catherine. Catherine, this is your future classmates. Come on over here. And what I have for Catherine here is the following. In just a couple of moments' time, I'm going to show Catherine a picture. And Catherine, your charge is not to tell everyone what to draw, but how to draw it. In other words, if you in the audience cannot take for granted what this higher level object is, we're going to find that it's quite hard to function without abstraction. So if you would, into this microphone, describe for the audience exactly how they should draw what only you see.
Are there rules?
That is the only rule. You should not say what it is, just how to draw it. They have a pencil and a sheet of paper to which they can apply that pencil.
Okay.
Step one.
All right. So you have to keep in mind that all of the lines will be equally spaced apart. So first, you should draw a Y in the center of your paper. Okay. And then from your right-hand side, from that, from the end of the top right-hand side of your Y, draw a straight line down towards your belly button. Not diagonal, straight line. Make sure it's parallel to the paper. Do the same to the other side so that the entire drawing is symmetrical. And then from the bottom of your Y, draw a line parallel to, okay. So when you first started out with a Y, you have three lines, right? So there's one on the top. Oh, no.
It's okay.
Oh, no. Okay. I hope no one saw that. Okay. So you have one on the top right-hand corner and one on the top left-hand corner. So you want to connect the lines from that you drew parallel to your belly button to the bottom of the Y. Can you guys do that?
All right.
I feel like this is terrifying.
This is what, terrifying? Yes, it is now.
Okay.
So give them another instruction or two, and then I'll collect some of the answers, and we'll see how close we just got.
Okay, and then so you guys all know what the roof of a house looks like. It's like a triangle. So give your Y a roof of a house so that the Y looks like a square.
Becoming a little less abstract now, but.
Oh, okay. Oh my God.
And how about two more instructions to get them to the end?
I don't know what wouldn't give.
Well, then let me do this. Let me get you off the hook here. It's actually a wonderful reinforcement of the message, which is that life is hard without abstraction. But let me, a round of applause for Catherine here. Let me come out and claim. And real fast, if I could just steal a few of the incarnations of these drawings. One, two, I'll come down here. Three, four, five, six. That'll do. And let's see just how close we came then to what Catherine was encouraging you to draw. And I'll do so by swinging into video mode here. So we have one such drawing. All right, so we have one such drawing. All of them actually look pretty similar. So a little something like that. This one, too, pretty similar. Missing something on the bottom. And this one here. And actually, amazingly, whether by sheer application of those commands or a little bit of a flip of the paper there, we have what was indeed before Catherine, which was this image here, which might jump off. Might jump off the page at you as, of course, hey, draw a cube. But when you don't have that higher level abstraction and actually need to do it from the ground up, that's why this idea of abstraction is just so key. And this, then, is just one of the ideas that you would learn in the world of computer science and just one of the ideas that you would learn at the coming fall start. And allow me to conclude here with a look at just some of the other ideas and experience that await you in a course called CS50. CS50, Harvard University's introduction to the intellectual enterprises of computer science and the arts of programming.
If you walked in here today, you'd see hundreds of people crowded around their laptops, smiling, laughing, thinking.
Thank you all, whether or not you participated in this exercise or not, and especially thanks to our faculty members today who really have brought us quite a show. If you had to draw a conclusion, which happily you don't, but if you did have to draw a conclusion today, one of the ones you might draw is that this ain't no ivory tower. Harvard is admittedly a very pragmatic place, but I think you saw it on full display. I also can't help observing that with all of the talk in the media today about are people too focused on this or that or the other thing and not narrow enough, or by the other token, are people too broad in their interest, an inch deep, and so on. We see a lot of people today, five of them in particular, who do a lot of things at a very high level of expertise, but who do a lot of things, and we thank them for joining us. Now, I'm supposed to remind you that there are many other things to do. I know you have read books that tell you all the things you could be doing in the next period of time. There will be a couple of returns I hope you will make to this very building tonight. There'll be dinner in Annenberg Hall right across the way, and there will be the wonderful, famous Palooza concert here after that in the evening around 9 or something, and a number of other things to keep you terribly busy in the meantime. Thank you so much for joining us in Cambridge.